Welcome in to the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Got an excellent show for you today, folks. You know, every once in a while, you find someone that you absolutely just love to talk to on different topics and someone who is a master in their craft. And we're bringing back a guest today who has a brand new book out there. It's called Source Magic, The Origin of Art, Science, and Culture. Carl Abramson is our guest. He's a writer, publisher, magico-anthropologist. I know I've slaughtered that. And filmmaker, the author of A Culture Resonance, I believe. We're going to have to ask him about that. We also talked to him about Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan, as well as the editor and publisher of the Anthology of a Culture, the Fenris Wolf, and he lives in Sweden. Let's bring him in now, Carl Abramson. How are you, Carl?
Doing fine. It's a beautiful winter day here. We had lots of snow yesterday, and it's crispy clear and cold, and it's just wonderful. And I'm very happy about the book, too. I'm very happy to be on the show.
We're happy to have you, my friend. Like I mentioned at the top there, every once in a while we get somebody here on the show that I absolutely love to sit down with and talk whatever subject you've got, because you have a brilliant mind. So I loved sitting down with you and talking with you and taking a peek into that brilliant mind and seeing what's
Thank
there.
You.
This book, I'll tell you, when you talk about subjects and peeking into that brilliant mind and seeing what's there, you go on a lot of adventures, my friend, a lot of adventures, and you love to peek into brilliant minds and see what's there. There are plenty of adventures in this book, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right when saying that I also love to look into brilliant minds. It's something that I've been doing since I became not only interested in the occult and sort of weird art and fringe culture, but also, you know, along the way, I've had this, I wouldn't call it, you know, it's not a pathology, it's not a predilection. It's just something that I've been, I just enjoy whatever I'm inspired by, mm-hmm. whatever fills me and makes me, you know, tick, I want to share, you know, repackage. And, you know, that's why I became a journalist originally, you know, telling my own story through other people's stories in a way. And that's been an increasing thing. And it's been the same thing as I've gone deeper and deeper into the field of the occult and sort of studying magic and practicing magic, but also being, you know, interested as an anthropologist. That's why I came up with this sort of title, you know, that I'm a magical anthropologist. I am genuinely interested in how humans and human culture relate to the phenomenon of magic, and also vice versa, you know, what kind of role it has played in human development. So, and that I want to share. It's not just mm-hmm. for myself. Mm-hmm. I have that inclination that I want to, as you say, look into other people's minds. There are people who are actively involved, and it could be any culture. It could also be historical persons, and it could also be, you know, contemporary pop culture expressions of it. It's just, I found everything really, really fascinating. And this new book, Source Magic, is basically, like the previous one, O Culture, an anthology of essays and lectures, pieces I've written for various, you know, books and magazines. But there is that red thread, in a way, mm-hmm. that it has to do with, you know, with the title of the book, you know, Source Magic. Mm-hmm. What is the source? It is that we all have this relationship. Either it's conscious, meaning I'm aware that I have a relationship with the original magic source that the ancient shamans were the ones that dealt with, and now today we can all do it in a way. Or it could just be that feeling that some culture that we take part of, like a movie, for instance, or a book, we just feel that there's something there, but we can't really pinpoint what it is. And often in conversation, we tell our friends or overhear someone else saying it, whoa, that film was so magical, you know, but what does that mean? You know,
right.
It's just something that is out of the ordinary, something extra, some, you know, cosmic stardust, whatever. It's just not a banal thing. It's something that really moves you and shakes you. And I believe that it touches on us on individual, also collective levels. That's why certain films and, you know, franchises like, I think, you know, Lord of the Rings, for instance, really touch upon many of these sort of mythic things that go way, way, way back in history. is beyond medieval times and everything that sort of, you know, could have been the creative impetus for Tolkien to write these things. But it goes, you know, further back than that. And it's this thing where you as an individual or a tribe or a culture have this need of transcendence, you know, going beyond your own rational mind to acquire information. And it's not like raw data. You know, we use today the word data for information.
Right.
But I mean, it could also have to do with things like basic survival or basic wisdom, how to deal with people like on an emotional level. We have a storehouse of information inside us. And I'm saying, you know, inside our beautiful brains and minds, because they are also flowers coming from the seed that is genetics. You know, everything that all of our ancestors have brought to the table of today, you know, it's all there. And I'm not saying that we could just like, you know, like a hard drive, you know, tap in certain keywords and it will find it for us. But it has to do with approaching it in a respectful way and also in an open-minded way. And that can be done completely, you know, without drugs, without any sort of extra thing. I would call it, you know, the best thing, best approach is simply meditation. And usually when we talk about meditation, you know, you have the East, the Eastern aspects, where it's about stilling the mind and sort of calming the ripples of the mind.
Sure.
But it could also be a meditation that actually goes on this quest inside yourself, inside your own mind, to find certain kinds of information. So I'm just, you know, this kind of intuitive approach with a quest in a way. You're out to get something. It might not be exactly what you're after, like an inner dialogue that's crystal clear. It could also pop up like in symbols. And of course, the metaphor or the parallel thing that we are very accustomed to is dreams, right?
Right.
You know, dreams, that's an irrational sphere. We accept that dreams exist because we accept that sleep exists. No one can say that, no, dreams do not exist. Because we know they do, because we experience them every night. Not remembering them as often as we would like,
right?
That's a fact.
Right.
But we can train it to a certain extent. But anyway, that's also a sphere in which we can see. It's almost like movies, and it has symbols. And of course, is this completely just like mind garbage? You know, processing the stuff that happened through the day, you know, and our some kind of wish fulfillment that we can't achieve in real life? I don't think so. I think it's much more substantial than that. It's just a different kind of processing going on in a different state of mind.
Why does science push us towards wanting to think that that's the way of the brain just clearing out the day's activities? Why are they so insistent that this is just the brain psychologically clearing out the business? Why can't we accept that maybe that the brain is opening a portal to something more supernatural?
Yeah, I wish I had a general answer to that. I don't. And also, I think it's maybe mistaken to generalize to say that all of science is one single cluster. However, I do think that some scientists are definitely more conservative or reactionary than others. And I think you're referring to those people who adamantly, you know, deny the possibility that dreams could be actually, you know, meaningful, and that transcendental experiences in meditations, in shamanic journeys, even in psychedelic experiences, could have substantial value for us, maybe not on a collective level, but for us as individuals. It's us talking to ourselves. It's deeper, hidden, or if you will, occult layers of our existence and mind, making itself or themselves known to the more rational processing. And the reason why that happens is because there's a need for it. And one of the theses or sort of premises of the anthology Source Magic is that we need more of this magic in the times that we're living in, because of the dire straits, because of the confusion, because of the old power structures that cling to this antiquated way of dealing with things and looking at things for power purposes. And it's a shame, because I believe that there needs to be a kind of an individual awakening in order to connect to other people who are also awakened in a way. And that kind of mind frame, where you see us as being living active agents and cells, if you will, of one living organism. If you have that approach and that outlook, it becomes much easier to see that, you know, okay, so it's better if we work together on this because I'm just one tiny cell.
Right.
I may be awakened, but we need to work together, for instance, to combat the one particular disease of the organism as such. Basically, magic is part of a immune system that, when growing, could become powerful enough to fight antiquated ways of thinking, and also that leads to causal things where you could stop certain detrimental effects of humans basically. Mm-hmm. and get this ship going in a better direction.
Got an interesting thing to throw at you here, Carl, and something that I observed and noticed, which I kind of want to throw your way too. I know it's a little off the subject of the book, yet it ties in kind of perfectly with it, and that is, before I had surgery, I was out at Disney World in Orlando. And you want to talk about the perfect mix of the one thing that's taking us away from source magic right now, which is technology. Technology is really pulling us away from that magical center that I feel like we all have inside of us. And combining it with what we describe as a magical experience, like you mentioned a few minutes ago. When we think of a magical experience, one of the first things everybody comes up with, especially when we're dealing with our children, is Disney. We think, oh, Disney, we'll take our kids to Disney for that quote unquote magical experience. Carl, I got to tell you, they've tied technology to that magical experience like you wouldn't believe. You can't go around Disney World now without either a card or a wrist bracelet to track wherever you're going. Or if you want the genie experience, you got to have it on your phone and you have to book your ride for the lightning line or to book your ride or book your experience. Everything magical is tied to technology now. It never used to be that way. Mm. So is this the future of magic, that technology will be tied to our magical experience?
Very good question. I think that how they have sort of used the term, again, magical, it's one of the most used and abused and misused adjectives in our language, you know, because what does it really mean? I think they sell it, this sort of, you know, you come in there as a kid, like the first time, mm-hmm. and you're in awe of all of these, you know, fantasy figures that come to life. That in itself is magical. And I think the... you don't see the division there between what's causing the illusion in a way and the perception of the illusion, meaning that it doesn't matter if there's some goofy guy inside a big bear costume or if it's an animatronic thing, or maybe it's a projection of like a holographic projector in a way. Mm-hmm. Kids are just, they want to be amazed, and that is the magical aspect of it. So in a sense, I see that, yeah, I can see that, you know, the integration of technology is completely natural for us humans. I think we're about soon, if we haven't already, to go overboard. I think with the AI thing, it's too late. You know, it's the snowball that sets the avalanche in motion.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be very, very tricky to get out of it. You know, you have to like shut down major computer networks and stuff. But that's a topic for another discussion.
Sure.
I think that for kids to go into this, you know, it's called the Magic Kingdom, right?
You know,
you go into the Disney thing and you want to be amazed. And it is amazing on many levels. I was there not too long ago, both Disneyland and World, and found it very fascinating. But of course, we can't go in there with the, you know, with the open mind of a child and just be amazed. We all sort of, we have, it's like a, what do you call it? It's like a protection thing where you have an almost cynical approach saying, oh, it's so crass, it's so commercial. But at the same time, it is a lot of fun.
Yep.
And, you know, whether you like to go on rides or just take part of it, it's amazing. And I do have great respect for at least, you know, Disney's original vision for Disneyland,
mm-hmm.
and then how other, you know, corporate structures move that onwards may not have been to Disney's liking. We don't know. We can only speculate. But this thing of having a secluded area where you go in and experience something completely different from your normal mind frame, that is inherently magical.
Yeah.
And whether that's like old school with mechanical rides, or again, people inside costumes, or whether it's animatronics and more advanced technological rides, I don't think that matters to the kid. Because for them, that technology is completely integrated already. You know, when they get their first little digi watch and when they get the first smartphone, that has sort of replaced the rites of initiation, you know?
Right, yeah.
Where whatever, a confirmation or a bar mitzvah or whatever, is just like all about getting the new gadget.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Then the latest gadget after that.
Yes,
you
of course.
And then,
got to keep up, and that'll you know, give you a life of being in debt and in, you know, mortgaged.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also another topic for another time.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, again, I think the sense of wonder is important. Magic is not only about, you know, causally affecting change to get what you want. It has been defined like that, and I can certainly see the magical aspects of it, because it is, magic is tied in with a philosophy of will, you know. So what do you want? Well, I want this. Well, if you procure that and get that, that becomes magical then. But I believe also, at least culturally, that it needs to have that, you know, cosmic stardust sprinkled over it, that becomes something phenomenal, something extra, something super, something beyond the normal rational mind. And I think that for kids, that's a natural state of mind. Any little, you know, pine cone or stick can become something else by magical transformation in their interpretation of the sensual data, in a way. And I wish that we could do the same. If we really try hard, we can. For instance, in these sort of open-minded meditations or other kinds of, you know, mind-expanding techniques or substances, whatever. And I think a lot of that extraneous stuff is not really needed. The source in the source magic that I'm talking about is kind of a shamanic approach,
okay,
where you can travel on frequencies, but you know, the archaic ancient drumming, the mm-hmm. rhythm, you know,
yep.
And again, to tie in with your recent experiences, the heart is the original rhythm,
yes,
of life, you know, and that's why I think the shamanic drum has that kind of rhythm. We resonate with it, and we can travel on it on those frequencies. Or the frequencies in the syncopations or the silence in between. It doesn't matter, but it works. And it costs nothing. It is problem-free. There are no side effects. You just go on this inner journey to what's usually called the underworld or the overworld, with like on a different frequency. And there you realize, whoa, I experienced all of these weird things. Mm-hmm. So am I crazy? No, you're not crazy. You're getting a new kind of information. And if you can either reject it, saying, this is not real, it's an illusion, it's a mind trick, or you could say, it's real, I'm going to validate this, I'm going to value this as a wonderful experience, and I'm going to also integrate it, you know, take it one step further and interpret whatever it was in terms of signals or messages that I got there. Because it's not something outside us talking to us, like, you know, in the movies or in the scare propaganda, whatever. It's just you talking to a different layer of yourself. And it's only for the good.
Okay.
It's only for the, like, the psychic hygiene or the benefit of a more immersive human experience. And it's all basically shamanic. And why is this the source? Well, it's because this mode of acting in give specifically like ritual situations that has existed in every culture on this planet that we have, you know, archaeological or old records of, at least, you know.
Right.
But it's very likely that it's so part, such a strong part and big part of our development as, you know, going from humanoid to actually human, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of the survival instinct. We have to process all kinds of information in order to survive, not only sensual data coming in, you know, there's a lion, let's run or fight.
Mm-hmm.
There's an enemy, let's, you know, fight or flight. But there's also more to it in terms of developing skills within, you know, processing. And that's where this comes from. Through ecstatic moments, we can process data in a different way, literally a different mind frame. And that has been extremely beneficial and conducive to progress. You know, just as the development of tools. How does that come about? Well, it's someone processing the data of, you know, in a way, empirical experiments. If I take this club and beat the enemy over the head, that's a good tool. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, something sharp that you can sort of cut things with.
Right.
But it's not only, you know, looking at things and then it needs cogitation, like rational cogitation and deduction, you know, processing data, but also on the inner levels where you get these aha moments. Wow, I just looked at this stick yesterday. What if I take it up tomorrow and see if it's good for something? That kind of what if thing that is the essence of our science too, you know, but right. That comes in moments of either, you know, ecstasy or deep meditation, you know, basically when we're not doing this, like talking rationally to each other,
yep.
But perhaps talking irrationally to experiencing things that are irrational or strictly emotional or nothing at all, just silence and peace, you know,
in those
and
moments.
That is the shamanic experience is still at the very core of our life experience. And the people who negate that and say it's not real, it's just illusion, they're probably afraid of seeing what kind of wealth they have inside themselves.
In those quiet moments, you know, you have to wonder what exactly or how exactly that thought formed that you know, I need to go deep within myself and figure out what exactly is out there, what exactly formed me, what exactly, you know, where exactly my origins came from, and then to reach out and try to figure out how that happened. That's a fascinating moment. But then to actually get something from beyond is another fascinating moment. And then to keep that give and take going, it's amazing that we get to where we are now. You know, it's a fascinating journey.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting also how, in a way, the development of technology, and I mean, perhaps specifically digital technology or the invisible technology, sort of emulates the human brain in everything it does. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the internet is an emulation. Computers are an emulation. Artificial intelligence is obviously an emulation of real human intelligence. And it's just interesting because I don't think we have a choice. You know, mm-hmm. humans are inherently innovative. That's also part of our survival instinct. So we can't say, let's just stop here and let's not innovate anything. You know, that will never work.
No.
Because there's the a profit incentive and there's an altruistic incentive and there's so many things. However, I always get suspicious when things move too quickly. And,
yes.
you know, suddenly you have these sort of not only the internet, but now you, or computer capacity, but now you have soon, or maybe they even exist in clinical environments, these super supercomputers that can compute things so quickly and such astronomical amounts or quantities of data that we can't even fathom with our own brains. So it seems that technology in that sense is catching up or perhaps even surpassing us in our original inherent qualities. And then of course you have this thing with AI, which is very popular on social media. Say, hey, I told the AI to make this picture or write this short story or this academic, you know, paper. And it's like, it's almost real, you know. It gives the semblance, simulacrum in Latin. It gives a semblance of being the real thing, but it's not the real thing. But then again, what is it? Because it's you can read the piece, that's not a problem. And you can see the artwork and say, well, that's quite beautiful. Or you can do, you know, basically anything in terms of your own evaluation of it, but you get down to the original, you know, blind test.
Right.
You know, where we have, you know, Coke and Pepsi and Jolt and whatever else, cola, and then you have to taste it and say, what is it? Is it the original or is it a copy, a knockoff? You know, and very soon...
There's something I want to show you here and talk to you about, but I didn't want to interrupt your thought.
No, I'm just saying that I think we're really in a critical mass moment right now.
Yes.
Where things will soon be so smooth and so good at emulating and copying how we communicate, what we do, what we produce, and what we create, that, you know, the actual result of it is that us as human individuals, we are pretty redundant. You know, they say that, you know, we do these things in order so people don't have to work so much, but why shouldn't we work? We're born, you know, we were made to work, you know, why should we let a computer emulate us to the point where we become redundant?
Right.
It doesn't make sense. You know, it's moved too quickly. Yes. And of course, anyone who's ever read any kind of good science fiction knows that this is not good.
No.
This is not going to end well.
It always ends badly. Right along that thought. Okay, so maybe about 2 months ago, a month ago, 2 months ago on Supernatural News on our Wednesday segment, we read a story about an app called Historical Figures. Okay. And it's a chat app. It's a chat GPT app, AI app, where you are able to, now, of course, there's a little bit of cost to this. Of course, there's always a profit center for this, right?
Yes.
Right, Carl? So what's going on with this app is you can log in and there's over, I think it's 20,000 to 50,000 historical figures that you can chat with.
Oh, wow.
This thing is creepy. And it is disturbing. There's some you can chat with for free, but it's historical figures, and it's available on iPhone. Okay, not that I'm chilling for this thing at all, Carl. But I went on because I have a, as most people listen to the show know, my it's like 17th or 18th great grandfather is Bernard de Tremblay, who is the fourth Grand Master of the Knights Templar. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on to talk to Grandpa Bernard. Okay.
All right.
Right. Just to see what I could get out of it, to see if it was historically accurate at all. If it, and believe it or not, AI lies at times, Carl. I don't know if you know this or not, but there's times where it just can't fill in that gap fast enough. But this thing answers back right away. It's just boom, boom, boom. It fires back right away. Okay.
Yeah.
But it told me it had two different sets of children and two different sets of names. It didn't name anything accurately. It just kind of, you know, rushed back the fable quickly. It was interesting to talk to this thing, but I don't think it would be. And of course, it says it's for entertainment purposes only.
Yeah.
You know, don't get wrapped up in it or don't get it twisted. But you can talk to everybody from Jesus to Hitler to Jeffrey Epstein to whoever you want to talk to on this thing.
All the good people.
Yeah, all the good people. You can get titillated and excited and do whatever you want with this thing. I don't know what purpose it serves. But I tried it live on air just to see what it was. I haven't touched it since January 24th. Because it just, to me, I don't see the point in it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, but I would like to add something to that equation, if you will.
Sure.
And that's the thing that, how does this work? Well, of course, they enter names and they enter historical facts and information. I guess it's some kind of, you know, basic database thing. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have the basic parameters or algorithms of communication. Like first there's the subject and then comes the verb, you know, all these basic grammar things. And I'm sure that can be stylistically morphed. If it's someone from the 19th century, it'll be communicating in a slightly different grammar than you and I do, you know.
Yep.
So these are pretty basic things. And then, of course, as you said, you know, what's the point? And, you know, who's this for? And what's, you know, what should we use this for? But I would like to add also that many of these communications are completely possible in these inner spheres that you have. And I'm not saying that, you know, if you want to talk to your ancestor to get some answer about a specific thing, for instance, well, we could psychologically say that it's very unlikely that you will tap in directly to his or her mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
You will tap in to your apprehension, to your projections, to your hopes of what you want to get from that. So I wouldn't call it like a self-fulfilling prophecy, but it is touching on yourself, going through yourself, and then via whatever deeper psychological layer that you have, going into this ancestral sphere where you might connect to, and I would say very likely connect to that person. Okay. And then you'll get a flow of information. So having a choice between the algorithm that is completely distanced and completely technological and this proto-experimental attitude of going into your own psyche, because of course your genetics, you know, it's all there. Mm-hmm. Your ancestors exist in your genes. Mm-hmm. You know, that's mm-hmm. just a biological fact.
Yeah.
So why shouldn't you, in an experimental mind frame, be able to communicate with chosen parts of your own past? Because their lives are part of your past. So I'm just saying that with an open mind, you can find a lot of information. And I've done, you know, experiments with this myself, communicating exactly like this with ancestors.
Really?
And I would, what I have experienced there, I would validate higher than a tech app for profit, you know, because there's no way they can only talk back in ways that are more or less predictable.
Yes.
It's based on, you know, predictability.
Yeah.
Whereas what you get when you go deeper into yourself, it's not predictable at all. Mm-hmm. You will get crazy, kooky answers and conversations that, to me, proves that it's not just a rational mind that is slightly distorted at the time, but that there is something more substantial involved.
Very interesting indeed. I tell you what, let's take our break right here. When we come back, let's start to talk about some of these methods and how we tap into the different areas of source magic. Let's talk about, I want to get a little bit into psychedelics, because when we were talking before about sleep and dreams and whatnot, there was actually a article that came out in Time Magazine over the past week or two that talked a little bit about how about old hag syndrome. And how they believe scientifically you're actually tapping into a center of the brain that taps into psilocybin and your serotonin levels, which to me just seems like it's opening a portal. To me, it just seems like science just turned itself on its ear and said, well, you're opening a portal anyways. I want to talk to you about that as well, Carl.
Right. Absolutely.
So we'll do that here in the break. The book is Source Magic, The Origin of Art, Science, and Culture. Carl Abramson is our guest. We have a link in the description of the show. Go ahead and get the book during the break. When we come back, Source Magic. We'll talk about the who, what, when, where, and why, and the different methods right after this on the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest is Carl Abramson. He is the author of the brand new book, Source Magic, The Origin of Art, Science, and Culture. It's available right now. You can go click on the link in the description of this program and get yourself a copy of the book. Carl, before the break, we were kind of talking a little bit about how you can start to manifest this magic that's within you or able to tap into sources that are outside of you that you can tap into. One thing you were mentioning was being able to tap into that ancestral wellspring. We'll put it that way. That's within you. There are other wellsprings outside of you that you can tap into. One of the things I want to talk about, I mentioned psychedelics, and I want to start off by something I teased before the break, and that was on Supernatural News this past week. I had talked about old hag syndrome or sleep paralysis. And a scientist came out with an article where he tried to debunk sleep paralysis as a supernatural phenomenon. And he tried to end ghosts, ghost hauntings or demonic hauntings during sleep paralysis. And tried to say, nope, it's all in your head. The third thing he mentioned in there when trying to debunk it was, well, your brain is being flooded and your serotonin centers are being flooded by serotonin and psilocybin. Well, psilocybin is a psychedelic, which is otherwise known as LSD, which has been used in different ways to try to, well, for one, it's been used for PTSD patients to help them. It's been used in curing alcohol addiction. And it's also been used to help people spiritually get to the other side and have experiences where they can connect magically or spiritually. So my question would be, aren't you just opening up another portal, Carl, and isn't this a magical experience you're having when you're waking up from sleep?
I would say so, absolutely, and also falling to sleep. You know, both the hypnagogic and hypnopompic states are absolutely magical in the sense that they are not rational. They're also not completely dreamy. You know, they're sort of in between, and that's makes this sort of borderland or sort of gray area in between is very interesting. And I think also that what we experience there, because that's completely unaffected by outer things. Mm-hmm. You know, we are natural when we sleep and we dream and we wake up. We're also natural when we are awake and fall asleep and then sleep. So it's no extra technology or substances involved. And I think that's, you know, eternally, endlessly fascinating. And I think that people probably are more frustrated about not having good enough dream recall, but it's so overwhelming and the day begins and you're completely fragmented and you have to get on, you know, have your coffee and go to work or whatever you do.
Yeah.
That's, you know, a big part of waking life. But at the same time, you know, you have this thing where, well, 1/3 of our lives is spent sleeping, mm-hmm. you know, if you're a normally balanced person. And that's a huge chunk of time and experience. And of course, we know, and at least scientists can, even if we don't have recall, scientists can, you know, measure electroencephalically or whatever they use to see that with certain points, certain cycles, there are more activity in the brain, which means that it's very likely that we dream then. And of course, whatever it is that is triggering these experiences in dreams or hypnopompically, of course, it is something that is needed, you know, because nothing is really redundant in our system. Our system, whether awake or asleep, it's completely geared for maximum optimal efficiency, even in rest, you know, to rest in an optimal way. Mm-hmm. And so the brain goes down in a lower gear. And that apparently sets things free. And you and I, certainly, we don't buy this thing where it's just like, you know, processing of data garbage in our brain, you know. Right. There's something more to it, absolutely. And I think actually most people would agree, you know. And I think also most people would agree to having experienced things in life which are completely out of the ordinary. Could be contacts with an ancestor, maybe recently deceased, or just the sort of this synchronicities that appear that you think about someone and then so that person comes up basically, and there's a lot of magical thinking. We are completely immersed in magic, whether we can accept it or not. And I'm not trying to sort of proselytize or sell anything, but I do wish at times that people could become more, as I said before, awake to the fact that we are living just as our genes, you know, program the way we look and the way our health is and all that stuff. We are also carrying on a lot of genetic baggage that is very interesting, but it's our ancestral baggage, meaning that whatever they learned during their lifetimes, you know, then they procreated, that thing moved on. It's part of a very slowly moving mutation development process. And in that process, there is of course information about what we need to do to stay alive and you know, be quick in our evaluation of situations and all of these sort of basic existential things. As this is another interesting aspect, you wanted to move this to like a psychedelic arena, and I think
I'm kind of interested in this genetic thing. Are you saying we can't necessarily fight our genetics, or can we add to our genetics? So is there something?
I believe we add by living. We add to our genetics, but then of course, what we experience after moments of procreation, like in a family situation, we beget new life, etc. That becomes a little bit redundant, right? Because it cannot be passed on.
Sure.
So. Yeah. We pass on whatever we have experienced up until the moment of procreation with a new mother that begets new life, you know. That's just, it's like a little advanced tape recorder of experience. And I'm not saying that all of the experience is stored like it's some you know, a humongous hard drive, to use a technological example. I do believe, though, the things that we have, you know, processed and find that our entire system finds useful, they are passed along. Because what good would it be for us to remember how an ancestor, say, 23,000 years ago, felt when they drank some water? That's kind of redundant information. However, that ancestor might have been the same who found out a technological innovation that helped his family, his tribe, and his community. That will very likely be passed on because it has value, you know, utilitarian value. And I think it's the same for us, you know, if we are constantly living in environments that are so toxic, you know, our genetic and also life experience will be accumulation, not only of toxins that will, you know, kill us as individual organisms, but if we also procreate, it will very likely lead to some kind of mutation in order to stay alive further on down the line, you know. Maybe someone gets it, let's stop this toxic thing, or let's move out of this sphere where everyone is sick, you know. And that's the problem in our communal habitat today, meaning the earth as such, because there are very, very few places that are untainted by the human experience,
right,
unfortunately. Right. And so where can we go? Well, I think the best way to go is to actually stop the negative instead of being, you know, escapists, because that's basically what the nomadic experiences, you know, they couldn't grow things in the winter because it was cold. So you move on to greener pastures, right? That's the nomadic thing. But then after, you know, a while, and when the setting was good, became more of an agrarian culture, which then led on to the discovery of many new things in, you know, cultivation and things like that. And then, of course, today we're living in I wouldn't call it a nightmare. We're definitely living in a technological dream, where we as consumers, users, we don't understand how these things work, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
For instance, how is it that you are in the US, I'm in Sweden, we can communicate in real time? If we had, you know, described this to someone from the, you know, 18th century, they would call us witches.
Right.
They would say that, we would burn at the stake, you know, because there's obviously some kind of magic involved here, because we are dealing with invisible forces that allow us to communicate with each other, two wizards in a technological dreamscape. It is fantastic, and it has many good effects. But at the same time, what happens when you don't know what's going on? When, you know, before, in archaic times, the data was so raw, it was so basic, and we could understand. And at some point, I think we lost touch when every little profession became more and more specialized, and the physicians were no longer, you know, just helping out with broken legs and making those outer things secure, but actually now, you know, doing surgery inside people's brains. And as you with cardiovascular things, there's just, it's like pure science fiction,
but it's
now science, you know? And there seems to be, I don't think, an exponential speeding up. You know, if you look at human development, a lot of things happened during the 20th century, for sure, you know, with nuclear fission, nuclear fusion, and adverse uses of that energy, also good uses of that energy. And you have genetic insights, and then you have adverse and possibly good things. Everything has two sides, you know. And of course, the problem, one problem is that, you know, when you have science for profit, sometimes it's not the altruistic option that wins out, because maybe one industry has a vested interest in, for instance, people being sick in in a particular way so that they can sell the antidote. However, it's a hugely complex thing. And what I mean by increase, it seems to me that things are speeding up, you know, and you have in very few people an incredible amount of power to be these sort of almost shamans in a way, or jesters in yeah. another way, you know, yeah. provocateurs. I'm thinking, of course, like someone like Elon Musk, who creates this incredible, great thing with electrical cars, you know, this sort of taking it away from the fossil fuels, and at the same time, maybe not being completely balanced.
Yeah,
and he wants to go out in space. And it's not just dreams, it's, you know, doing real investment. And of course, at some point in the near future, people will go to Mars. That's not a big deal. Right. It has been predicted and programmed by science fiction for more than 100 years, you know, longer. Right. So it's just that now it seems that the science is catching up to these wildest, wildest dreams. But at the same time as this is happening, meaning, you know, progress, optimism, great new life, the habitat that we actually living in is going to hell. It's really, it's such a bad situation. And there's a huge discrepancy, or in America, you usually say there's a disconnect, yes. you know, between yeah. one and the other.
Yeah.
And that to me indicates that a lot of the technological process, even though it's profitable and stuff, it is basically escapism. It's some key innovative people who are obsessed with the idea of something, whatever, that is not dealing with the problems that we actually have here. They want right. to go somewhere else, yeah. you know?
Well, it's the idea that we are our own God. We, if, you know, mm-hmm. if this one is crumbling around us, we'll just build a new one. We, you know, we've got... it's the spirit of American ingenuity. Well, you know, it's well, if this one's broken down, we'll just fix it. Or, you know, it seems like at times the ego is bigger than the realism of what is actually going on around us.
Yeah, exactly. And that, again, is why I think it's very, very crucial and important to communicate with more aspects of yourself than the merely will-driven aspect, because that is tied in with so many things that are not conducive to a great outcome. It could be compensatory facts, for instance, when, you know, someone feels, well, let's call it the inferiority complex, and then you have someone who compensates because they don't feel adequate on the inside. Mm-hmm. So they compensate by having bigger this and bigger that, or creating bigger this and having more money, whatever, and it creates ripples on the outside. One person's imbalance, you know, and then you have an entire culture that is imbalanced. Imagine the ripples. Instead of looking inside and saying, oh, I should work on this with myself and probably I should be, you know, a more balanced and healthier person. But instead of doing that, everything is outside compensation. It could be on the surface level, like, you know, having a brand new car, getting bigger boobs, whatever it is, you mm-hmm. know, to again, like a simulacrum, showing something that is not really real. I mean, it is real in many senses, but it's not really the real you. You're doing it as a compensation for feeling inadequate mm-hmm. on the inside. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to go again to the source with very, you know, simple means, just communicating with yourself and see who you really are. And when you know that thing, then it's you know, a fantastic journey in which you radiate inspiration also to other people so they can deal with themselves. And the thing, I think the biggest threat here is it costs nothing. You know, there yeah. can be no competition yeah. here, because it's not really a commodity. It's just, you know, human intercommunication.
Right.
And of course, let's not forget also that we come up with great things as human beings
mm-hmm.
while communicating, like you and I now, you know, you have one mind, I have one mind.
Mm-hmm.
Together, we create a third mind that can actually make us both realize new things that we hadn't thought of before.
Right.
That's that in the nature of human communication. And that also, lo and behold, costs nothing, right?
Right.
So this
right.
basic human communication that is so revelatory, that is so creative, that is so innovative and problem-solving, is not something that's really stressed. Instead, we do it via technological gadgets like smartphones and apps and AI. And when we communicate, it's not in a flowery language that, you know, encourages the other person to think in a new way.
Right.
It's by simplifying and using like simplified images to convey a human emotion. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is an indication that we're going completely the wrong way.
Yes.
Yeah. According to me, you know,
no,
it's just
right,
like, you know,
right.
When you send someone, instead of saying, I'm very disappointed in you, and the reason for this is this and this, when you have a clarification, instead people send each other poop emojis, you know, and it really, it takes the edge out of, and the value out of being human.
Well, even, you know, even if you say, I'm disappointed in you, it can be taken in a context that maybe isn't in the context you're wanting to put it in. I mean, it's open to interpretation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I think, but then again, you have these people who are amazing people. I'm not sure. I think Steve Jobs was one of those people, and I'm not sure about Elon Musk yet. He seems to be more of a child, actually. But I'm thinking of great, you know, people like Tesla, of course, and Buckminster Fuller specifically, who was so incredibly like a universal genius in a way. Mm-hmm. Needed to be fixed, could somehow be fixed, and quite inexpensively, just by, you know, using his brain and also communicating with other people, innovating things together. And it's just amazing. What if more engineers and science people were like that, you know? But I believe that one great problem is that the market as such requires specialization, you know, whereas Buckminster Fuller, for instance, he had a mind that was all encompassing. You know, he could think of things in different fields because there were so many similarities in between this field and that field. Whereas now it's almost like an environment that encourages scientists to have blinders on. So you focus on your thing and nothing else in order to make it more attractive, more better, more efficient, more profitable, of course. And then you don't see what other things these researches could be connected to create an actual solution that could benefit people and that has no inherent commercial value. And I'm not saying that it's wrong to make a profit from your innovation. Mm-hmm. On the contrary, that's a great thing. However, I think many of these things could profit from, again, or be more efficient if connected to other things, to other other specialized fields. Just to see things as a whole, not as an activity that requires specialization and only specialization.
Could it be argued, Carl? That inventors, not necessarily scientists that are focused on one thing or another, but inventors in general that are coming up with broad spectrum inventions are tapping into a type of a science, not science, but a source magic that they in themselves are getting something from the ether of the universe and are just a funnel for that.
Oh, absolutely.
That formula.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's the model, so to speak, or the funneling or the connection is absolutely possible within any human field, any human endeavor. And in the book, I've made a graphic model, which is that it's called an atomic model. So it could be a cosmic one where you have a sun in the center and planets revolving around it, or it could be an atomic thing specifically with a proton, and then you have electrons running around it. And no matter what you call it, the center is always the shamanic approach, you know, for human endeavors. Mm-hmm. It's going inside to get the real information. And then how that has developed into these spinning things, whether it's electrons or planets. The planets could be medical science. It could be philosophy. It could be art. It could be psychology. It could be, you know, biology. All of these human creations, distillations of thinking and intuiting, empirical, experiments. Basically human knowledge, they all revolve around this, the base, around the source, which is the shamanic experience. Mm-hmm. And shamanic, I know, it has inherently, people will say, you know, that's just a bunch of, you know, turned on people in the jungle. But what I mean is that you go inside, you know, it's an inner quest, an inner journey where you have to transcend the rational mind. So you don't even need to call it the shamanic. You don't need to call it by anything that's sort of hocus pocus or occult or anything. Mm-hmm. It's just pure psychology. You go to a deeper level of yourself, and there you will find new things that are not available to the rational mind, because the rational mind, it has great cogitation, has great deduction, has great sense of logic, but it is also hampered by that, because it's also like a policing thing, not letting through things that are, you know, divergent in a way. It's like a police force can create great order and make sense, but sometimes we also need a lot of nonsense or innocence in a way, that together can gel and create an idea that could move things forward.
So when we're at a point, even if you're not a great inventor, or you're not necessarily the most rich business person in the world, or you're not a land developer, if you're at a point personally where you need to move mountains, so to speak, maybe you're at a tough point in your life, instead of panicking, probably the best thing for you to do is to go inside yourself, like you mentioned before, meditating. Or is it safe to say, if you're not a meditator, something akin to prayer or something like that, where, or something where you just need to reflect? What's the easiest way to do that?
It's the same. It's the same thing. It's basically you formulating, something that you're not pleased with, or something that you are pleased with, and whether you're formulating it to God or a God or the gods, if you're in a, you know, within a religion that has pantheon with more gods than one, mm-hmm. or whether you're talking to yourself, or whether you're talking to an ancestor, it doesn't matter. The main thing is that you formulate to yourself, what's going on, what do I want to achieve, and how do I achieve it? And you know for a fact that your rational brain can't answer that, because you're in a pickle, you know, you're frustrated in the moment. And then you have to simply find a new way. And the best way is to go inside before you go out, you know, to check and recheck with yourself what's actually going on. And that requires not just, verbally asking a question, what should I do? It's about emotion also, about allowing yourself to feel in a certain way and allow yourself to be open-minded. Could be just that given moment, but at least to be absolutely honest and sincere in your endeavor of trying to get to know yourself better. Because before you do that, you can't really know. You are what you think you are, but you're also to a great extent what other people think you are. And you cater to those who are good to you. That's also part of the survival instinct. Yeah. And you sort of, you know, show disdain to those who are critical. That's basic human psychology also. But that's really surface level behavior. But there's more to you. You have quirks and substance and essence that you may not allow to come to the surface, because of the fact that it's not going to be accepted by your peers or the societal structure that you're in, parents, spouses, whatever. But you have to be honest, you know, otherwise it will be, you just postpone the problems. The sooner you can do this, I guess that's, you know, what Carl Jung called individuation. The sooner you begin with your individuation process, the faster you will be on your path. Otherwise it's likely that you'll be on someone else's path, at least with one foot, and that can create a sort of a discrepancy and frustration in life.
Explain that a little bit. How can you be on somebody else's path?
Well, if you are completely uncritical to outer information coming from, for instance, parents, school, society in general, employers, political adherents, any kind of authority, basically. And if you feel dissonance, if you feel that there's a discrepancy between what they want and what you want, then you're on someone else's path. You move along what you have been told is the best way to do things. So, and that could be, of course, what I meant by one foot on someone else's path. You could be sort of like a juggle. You could be in a compromise situation. But, you know, frustration will hit you sooner or later. You know, it will be, you know, in neuroses, if you're unlucky, it could be in psychosomatic illnesses or just a feeling of, you know, malaise, this sort of feeling of frustration and not feeling meaning. I think meaning is a key word in this thing. Mm-hmm. You are on the right track when you feel that your life has meaning. And if you don't, you better check and recheck again and be honest. I think that's also a key component that is very, very crucial, honesty.
Now, there's such a thing as being open and honest with yourself, and then there's such a thing as opening up. And again, we'll swing it back to psychedelics, if you will, and different ways of opening up. I know I myself, I'm not a meditator. I find it, I tried to explain it to somebody once where it's not falling asleep, but what it is I go to meditate and I black out, and it's almost like I pass out. It's like I hit a wall and I can't go further. And nobody seems to understand what I'm saying when I say that. It's not a conscious, it's not anything I can control. I don't know why I can't do that, but I can't. And they're like, oh, you're just lazy, you're falling asleep. But that's not what it is. But to people who are looking to open up more, is something like psychedelics, like ayahuasca or psilocybin or something like that, is that something that you would recommend somebody push that barrier with or try to open up in a different way if they're looking to cross that magical barrier?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say so. And of course, you have to, proviso, has to be, legal where you are, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that those recommendations or admonitions, in a way, really are kind of pointless or redundant, because kids, as we know, they will always seek out that transcendental experience through these means, through alcohol or through drugs. That's part of rites of passage, in a way. So that's not even an issue. If, for instance, if it were illegal where they are to do that, they will mm-hmm. still do it. Mm-hmm. But on a more serious, mature level, in the real individuation process, I think it can be very beneficial in controlled environments, as Leary said, set and setting, to use these tools of mind expansion to get to know yourself better. Not as escapism, not as a weekend pastime, but to really get into the core of yourself. The problem, I think, is that you need to go into it with a language that might be hard to acquire from someone else. You have to learn the language, which means usually slightly repeated experiments then. So, because the first times, whatever you do, will be kind of overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And it's like going to, I want to learn about this culture. And then you go to that place and you realize you're overwhelmed by the place itself. Mm-hmm. And you don't really learn anything because you're so amazed at the buildings and the colors and the food, all this stuff. Yeah. It becomes a sensory overload in a way. And my experience with psychedelic experiences is basically that can happen if you're inexperienced. It becomes so overwhelming that you try to write down during the experience what's happening, and fantastic, amazing. And then when you look at the notes afterwards in the sober state of mind, it's just like gobbledygook. It's doodles. But at the time it was completely meaningful.
Right.
So there you have to learn how it works and find that language so that you can, after the fact, try to tell yourself what or write down what actually happened and how it affected you and why it was a revelatory thing and what was revealed, So it's not just like, as they say, a trip. I think that can be a misleading word, because a trip is something that you go on and then you come back home in a way. But for it to be useful individuation experience, I think you have to stay on it, of course be at home or wherever you are, but retain the state of mind, retain the information and learn the language of the experience as such. Then it can be a very, very good tool. But then of course it's kind of hard, just like in the olden times people said drugs, that could mean a lot of things. It could mean opiates and psychedelics and central stimulants, whatever. It's a meaningless word. However, even within the psychedelic spectrum, the experiences are quite different. The only thing that's really generic or general is that the mind is affected. You know, some are designed to be good party drugs. So you have the sort of the increased empathy, and you have some nice psychedelic colors, whatever. And other things, that usually those that come from nature, that are sort of not produced in a lab, they can be quite violent and cause distortions of a kind that could be overwhelming and a bit terrifying.
Yeah.
But if you allow them to just roll with the punches in a way, then they will reveal things that are probably more useful to you than a designer party drug that has psychedelic qualities.
Yeah.
So there's a wide spectrum there, and you have to, as they say, choose your battles in the way. Choose, and I mean, that's not really easy either, because, you know, with the ayahuasca thing, that's a thing. You know, you mm-hmm. can probably find that if you work a little bit and get connected to someone who has something, and hopefully they're serious. Whereas all the other things are a little bit touch and go, you know, when you don't really know where the substances come from, or whether they've been mixed with something else. It's a bit of a paranoid culture, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
More than it used to be, yeah. I would say. And I think that if you're on the path, meaning if you're a serious, devoted, you know, journeyman or shaman or whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. And you have you know, you've decided that this is very meaningful and important to you, then magically, I can't explain this, but, you know, magically or synchronistically, things will begin to happen, and you will be sort of connected to people or events or maybe even substances or experiences simply that will be guiding you onwards. And I think the best thing to do is set out with an honest intention of being, you know, someone who's looking for finding your own path. And then a lot of things will happen.
Yeah. Yeah. The psychedelic thing has always been interesting to me, but I'm very much a skeptic. And to me, I would think that I would question at times whether the experiences I'm having are true hallucinations or are they actual spiritual experiences that I'm having, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a completely valid perspective and valid question. If I were to be your devil's advocate in this case, mm-hmm. I would say, what is the difference? If you have an experience caused by this or caused by that, and it brings you something that you feel is inherently valuable, is it then right, you know, for you to discard just because it comes from something synthetic, something, you know, man-made in a way? Or can you accept any experience that is provided to you as useful fodder in your individuation process? You know, some people who love old movies from the 50s, can they never appreciate a new high-tech animated 3D movie? You know, it's a matter of, again, perspective, and allowing yourself to be, I wouldn't say swept away, but affected by things that you didn't expect to be substantially affected by. And I think that is true for the problem with psychedelics and that kind of experiment is that you don't really know what you're getting into, mm-hmm. you know, because if you've tried it and have some experience, you know that it could swing here or it could swing there, you know, depending on what kind of input you're getting during the actual experience. It's a very persuasive state of mind that can easily be, you know, sidetracked. And of course, there is, you know, maybe under ultra controlled circumstances, on par with like an ayahuasca experiment.
Yeah.
Then of course you could have a really controlled setting and people who are completely sober and guiding you along the way.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. But how many people actually experience that? I think most people come into contact with the substances in environments and settings that are more violent. I mean, not physically violent, topsy-turvy in a way. Because they're affected by what's going on around them. Whereas in fact, if you want to use it for a kind of real soul-searching individuation, you should be calm and quiet and have input that is beneficial and inspiring to that mental journey.
Right. And if I were to try something like that, it would only be in a controlled environment with someone who were there that had administered it before and knows the effects and knows, you know, what exactly the medicine does. I guess a little bit too much of a control freak to do anything other than that, you know, as far as that goes. I want to switch gears a little bit here, Carl, and I want to talk a little bit about Morocco and the master musicians there. I want to talk about how music affects magic as we're starting to wind down here a little bit today on Darkness Radio. Of course, music, it's said, comes from the heart. And of course, the heart is would be the center of magic. Tell me, and you were talking a little bit before about how a drum simulates the beat of a heart. And of course, if the heart is connected to magic, then of course a drum beat would equal music. But go a little further into how these master magicians connect to music.
I think there's a mysterious experience that we can't really explain why. But, you know, but if you listen to music, and you don't know why you like a certain kind of music, but you hear something and you're not being watched, you know, you're not being watched by, you know, scrutiny or critical people or people who think that you're ridiculous, whatever. But what happens is that people are prone to start moving. People are prone to start dancing, you know, and that's true for, you know, major raves or discotheques or just, you know, nice home, you know, parties. People love to dance. Why is that? That's a very interesting question. And I don't think anyone has come up with an answer. Usually it's like sociological, where it's a preamble to intercourse. You know, it's something sexual that's not sexual. But I believe it's much, much more than that. Of course, we can see it in nature where you know, peacocks or whatever, they, you know, show their colors and flash their pizzazz, and the girls make themselves beautiful and alluring. Of course, it is something sexual in it, but there's something more in there also. And this feeling of being free, of being uncontrolled, of letting go. All these expressions we have to basically describe an ecstatic moment that is, of course, you know, very visible in the sexual relation and the sexual act also. So as soon as there's a drum beat, and some people may like, you know, funk, or they may like some old, you know, foxtrot or some old school jazz, whatever. Everyone has their own, you know, frequency and their own rhythm. You know, and then they will go crazy and they will start to move. I do it, you know, and not often, but when I listen to music that I like, that is not like, you know, classical music, but more like, you know, has a rhythm, has a beat, has a melody, then I do get agitated, you know. And why is that? I think it has to do a lot with the fact that that is one method of transcending the mind, leading the body to physical ecstasy. And we can also feel it in you know, other exercises like swimming or jogging or just physical exercise, and that's a purely analytical analysis is possible. It's the endorphins, right? Yes. Endorphins, you know, are unleashed. They make us feel good, and they also sort of make us trip out in a way, feeling good. And if you do that communally with hundreds of people, and you're dancing with a beautiful lady, then of course that thing, if there's empathy there and attraction, will lead on to something else, which is, you know, procreation or procreation by proxy, just casual sex. And I think it's something so proto-natural for us to dance and to be in that communal experience, but it requires music, it requires rhythm, it requires frequency that appeals to us. And I guess that's a cultural thing. Some people will get started on this kind of style or music, others will be on something else. But if there's something that unites all of this, it is rhythm, you know, rhythm and syncopation. And then you add frequency on top, and then, you know, gradually could add more things like melody, which makes us want to sing or sing along, even if it's completely gobbledygook. I mean, that's very visible in children. They can go goo goo gaga with some, you know, pop star, and it'll be fun for everyone. You know, it's just something catchy, you know, you go with the flow and it makes you feel good.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, I'm sure there are explanations to that, but I just, again, connect it to the source magic thing. That's something that we've done in the caves, in the forests, in the fields. We've danced together and reveled, you know, revelry and ecstatic mind frames. And then, of course, along with culture comes sources of inebriation. It could be alcoholic beverages or mushrooms, whatever. It's part of our culture. It's part of our existence. You can't eradicate that. We need it to have those experiences. Not every day, of course. That's abuse. But to use it and in a good cultural way.
Do you suppose, you know, I always... It's one of those things. You sit around, you have idle time, you start thinking, and you go within yourself, and you have these thoughts. And, you know, when I was young, I used to sit and think about, because I know you have an album out there, and we'll talk about that here in a moment, because I'm fascinated. For somebody who composes music, I have a guitar right to my left here, you know, and that I mess around with, you know, on more than one occasion, I guess, when I just need to hammer stuff out or get feelings out or whatever. So I think to myself, the beginnings of music and how it came about, do you suppose it's a, you know, a caveman on a rock, like you said, beating that club, and then eventually picks up two clubs and forms a rhythm? Does it come from a divine source? I mean, you know, as you sit there and you compose, that sometimes it feels like it just pours in from some other source that you don't know, you can't imagine where. But something takes over your fingers, or something just pours in from somewhere else, from some other source, and it almost feels like you're not in control. Have you experienced that?
Oh, absolutely, I have. I mean, I've made quite a lot of music. Very little of it has been composed. I was usually in my youth when I was working together with other people, and we needed some kind of structure that you could call, you know, rock and roll or new wave or whatever. The music I've made in my adult life has mostly been improvisational, but it's the same thing there. You know, you don't know where it's coming from. You just try things out and it's amazing. And then you add another layer or a rhythm or whatever, and it just works, you know. And that's pretty much what I'm talking about in the book also. And I'm thinking, you know, these philosophers along the, I won't say millennia, but a lot of people have speculated about this, you know, the harmony of the spheres, meaning that nature is organized in such a way as to create a harmony. And for instance, you know, there are different scales when you play music and you analyze music, and the what's it called, the pentagonal scale, you know, can be traced back to Pythagoras, who was a natural philosopher in a way. And there is incredible cosmic, again, psychedelic connections that you can find basically from looking at, for instance, the curve, the graphic curve of one note can be so revealing. But at the same time, that note can also be pleasant to listen to. And especially if there are more notes that combine, and then you have a rhythm. And then you have that entire universe opening up. It is totally magical. And I guess you could say that, okay, so we are susceptible, right? We're susceptible to frequencies because we hear with our ears. It's a frequency that sort of hammers our eardrum, you know, and makes us understand. We interpret those vibrations into sound, you know. And then you have people who can sing in perfect pitch, and then you have people who sing like crap, you know. It's weird. And the first people will become the singers because people want to hear something that is beautiful, inherently beautiful. And I think that creates well-being. We know that music can be soothing and inspiring. And I'm not talking about like lyrics. It could be the music in itself, the emotional value. And to tie it in with this Moroccan trip we had to the master musicians of Jujuka, that is very interesting because they are musicians. They're playing the same kind of music that's been played for thousands of years. There just is like an unbroken line of what you can call real panic music, meaning it's the celebration of Pan, who was, you know, this ferocious creature of ecstasy in the Mediterranean cultures. Could be the Roman, also Egyptian, Greco-Roman. There was always a Pan figure there who was sexual, violent, untamed nature, basically. And these musicians are playing music that you could call panic. It celebrates that. And it's in certain times, they also have a ritual where someone takes on the form of that panic force, you know, with in goat skins and becomes a great revelry and great sense of humor and also a little bit terrifying. And the music just keeps, you know, playing and playing and playing for hours so that everyone, you cannot escape. Everyone goes up, you know, I'm very sort of conservative and rigid, but I just can't help it. I got up and danced. It's impossible not to, you know, it's so persuasive and seductive.
That's a lot of energy. I mean, that's a lot of energy put out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's, of course, it leads to revelations about your own shortcomings, about the things you've never even thought about, connecting to other people, and you watch other people and they look goofy and you realize I look goofy too. You know, it doesn't matter. We're just having a great old time.
Yeah.
And people were not necessarily, you know, stoned or drunk or anything. It was just like this incredible music that is so vital, so streamlined over the millennia to have this exact effect of putting people in a trance in a way. It's trance music.
I suppose it kind of throw aside your, what's the word I'm looking for here, Carl? Your hesitations, anything that would keep you from, you know, your social
inhibitions, perhaps.
Inhibitions. Thank you. I was short on words there, Carl. You throw away your inhibitions and you just decide, you know what, if that guy looks kind of goofy doing it, I'm not going to look any worse. So.
Exactly.
Or that girl looks kind of weird and I'm not going to look any worse. And you kind of get wrapped up in the rhythm and you just go for it, you know? And
yeah, exactly. And that can create also interesting things, because when you shed those inhibitions and you're doing things, you're aware of yourself and you're in yourself, but you're also doing it together with other people. And it's not necessarily like a sexual thing. It's just a shared space where people are moving their bodies to great music. And you know, it's creates a kind of spirit, a kind of communal spirit that you can, you know, you can distance yourself from it or you can immerse yourself in it. It's just something pretty timeless. Again, I would say that's a source magic experience, because human beings have experienced that in many different forms, but it's always about creating something together, getting into the ecstatic mind frame together. And it's something we can never leave that. It's too ingrained in us.
Besides your books, are your albums on your website?
They are linked from the website. We have some of the albums on a site called Highbrow Lowlife. That's a kind of a record label that me and my wife have. And we have a Bandcamp thing or a page where people can listen to music. And some of them are on iTunes. I think the best way is to go to my webpage, carlabrahamson.com. Okay. And in the about section, there is a link to all the music.
All right. We'll have a link to the website as well. So it's in the description of the show. So people can go check out your music as well. Cause it's fascinating. It's fascinating to get, you know, in a well-rounded way, just not by the book. So cause you're a fascinating person, Carl. I really do enjoy getting to know you, through not just through the books, but sitting and talking with you. Kind of wrapping up here today, Carl, with Source Magic, I'm interested to know if there's someone out there that's listening right now that maybe is just kind of curious. They listen to paranormal programming and supernatural programming because they're curious, but they really feel like they're grounded in the current world. Like, you know, it's interesting, but, you know, it's not really for me. They feel like they're a million miles away from anything Source Magic. What's the one thing you can tell a person that's maybe sitting in their car listening to a podcast, or, you know, on public transportation, or sitting in their office and going, nah, I don't know that I think magic's for me? What's the one thing you could tell them to get them a little closer to getting in touch with their inner magician, so to speak, or getting closer to practicing magic, their own inner magic, every day?
Yeah, right, exactly. That's important to stress, though, because I certainly don't want everyone to become, like, you know, wand wielding magicians in full gear and, you know, sort of semi psychotic or Harry Potterish. But I would like to say that the greatest magic, of course, lies within, and there's a lot to be learned from and gained by being honest to yourself, looking at yourself, And I'm not meaning, you know, I don't mean looking yourself in a mirror necessarily, but to at least be honest in assessing and, you know, when looking at yourself, say, I am this, that means that I'm not that. If there's something in that that appeals to me, I should figure out why that is. Is it pure compensation and daydreaming? Or is there something of substance there that I can approach? And there you have the first question in this individuation process. What feels good in the moment? That's good. What feels bad in the moment? That's not good. You know, and then you have to deal with it. Otherwise, it will just linger on. So it's very, very basic. But I do believe you can call the process of individuation magical because it sets in motion things that would not otherwise have been set in motion. So it's a creative, proto-creative movement. And it's all, you know, you control the process and whatever you find will be of value to you. If you find something negative, then at least you will have found that and can work with it and deal with it. And if you find something positive, great. That's a reward. You have realized that, wow, I'm really fantastic in this sense. I'm going to go in that direction. You know, just keep on asking yourself questions and be honest, and you will be, you're already a magician in that sense.
What would you tell somebody who's on the opposite side of the spectrum, who thinks that magic is all pie in the sky, and hey, if I start harnessing this thing right now, boy, the rewards are coming in, I'm going to win the lottery, and life is going to be hunky-dory. What would you say to that person?
Yeah, I would say to that person that the crucial thing here, the key element, is the word I've used so many times, individuation, because there's a lot of, you know, crazy people involved in magic. I mean, like ceremonial magic and stuff like that too. And it's usually because they do have that kind of ego inflation. And ego, I think, is a great thing. But if you become deluded because you think you have a technology that will get you things faster or better, or you know, getting things you cannot otherwise get, then you are sort of deluded, and it's not really magic anymore. It's just escapism, where you use tools and technologies and, you know, collections of wisdoms to escape the fact that you are not that person. Whereas in fact, you could become that person if you only gradually take one step at a time and divest yourself of things that are bugging you and that weigh you down, and instead, you know, do that, but at the same time, acknowledge and laud yourself for the good things you have, the creative aspects. And, you know, you might find another person. I don't think there's an end, but along the path, you will find that you're perhaps not the person you thought you were, because other people have told you that you're that person, but you might actually be someone else. And you need to gradually get to know that person, because otherwise you live a life completely dictated by others, and you will be miserable and frustrated. So forget about the lottery. You will get, as the Rolling Stones said, you know, you'll get what you need. You can't always get what you want, but you'll get what you need. And there's a great wisdom in that song.
There is a lot of great wisdom in that song. You're absolutely right about that, Carl. Source Magic, The Origin of Art, Science, and Culture is the name of the book. Carl Abramson is our guest. We have a link in the description of this podcast. We also have a link to his website. Carl, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tim. It's been a pleasure, and I hope to talk to you soon again.
Absolutely. The pleasure's been all mine, my friend. Folks, want to remind you of a couple of things. One, Beer City Bruiser will be back next week, and Mally Fox will be joining us a little bit more here on the program, so we want to thank her for that. Two, we want to thank HelloFresh for being our sponsor this week. Thank you so much, HelloFresh, for believing in us and throwing your money where your mouth is. We appreciate that, as a matter of speaking or a matter of saying. Three, we want to thank you so much, the listener, for continuing to tune into this program and showing us your love and appreciation, and keep on keeping on. Please, if you love the program, tell a friend, tell a neighbor, tell a family member, and have them subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or whatever you listen to the show on. We appreciate that as well. Want to wish you a happy weekend. Have a good weekend, a safe weekend. Do a little something kind for someone who is in need out there, and take care of yourself and each other. And by all means, have a great weekend, and just have some fun while you're at it. Life is short, and make somebody's day out there. That's all I ask of you. Have a good weekend, everybody. We'll be back next week with more great shows right here on the best in paranormal programming. This has been Darkness Radio.